Hi, I'm Vernon Trollinger for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Pam Satchawacharapong, OD, Assistant Clinical Professor at the UC Berkeley School of Optometry and President of the Sclerolens Education Society. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in San Mateo, which is south of San Francisco, Bay Area native. I haven't really left except for residency.
What did your parents do?
My mom's a pharmacist, recently retired, so she's kind of enjoying life right now. My dad was actually a pharmaceutical researcher. I joke that he made the drugs and she sold them, but not really.
You mentioned that you grew up in the Bay Area, so what keeps you there?
You know, my family is still here. I don't have a whole lot of family in the States, and the family that is in the States is in the Bay Area. Most of my family is back in Thailand. But I was born in San Francisco and we just never really found a good reason to leave. The weather is great. You know, it's a little expensive to live here, but, I enjoy the culture. I like being around, you know, everything that the Bay Area has to offer. So we can, you know, do big cities. There are like, you know, beautiful, like natural forest reserves and, you know, or by the water. There's just a lot to be, lots to enjoy in the Bay Area.
Why specialty and scleral lenses?
When I was a pre-optometry student in undergrad, I actually went to UC Berkeley for undergrad also. I worked at a practice and the doctor there had specialized in contact lenses. So it sort of piqued my interest early. And as I went through school, I really, you know, had a good experience with the mentors in contact lens that I had there. And I really like that contact is sort of a niche that doesn't overlap a lot with ophthalmology. So we get to work in conjunction with them a lot. I get a lot of referrals from them to help patients who, you know, we might be able to help see better without having to resort to, you know, corneal transplant surgery or something of that nature. So a little less invasive. And that area of contact, the sclerals in particular, has grown a lot in the last decade. And we're fitting more and more of them. And so I think that I like being able to tangibly help a patient, you know, right then and there, you can really make a difference very quickly for a patient. And a lot of them are really grateful to not have to resort to surgery to see better.
Now, you mentioned that you did a residency. So how did you benefit from your residency?
So if you want to specialize in contact lenses, the type of lenses that we fit in residency, you know, you don't typically get a whole lot of it in school. You may be exposed to a little bit, but to really kind of immerse yourself into it, doing a residency gives you the high volume of patients that are really, I think, required to get, you know, very skilled at working with these lenses. So that's what all residency programs, I think, you know, can do for a newly graduated optometrist. The residency that I did was in Southern California, SCCO, MBKU now. And, you know, I had a great experience there. I really valued my time there. It's what actually got me kind of, I think, solidified in wanting to teach. Is my experience there. I originally was thinking, oh, you know, I really enjoy teaching, but I might do some private practice and kind of do both. But I really liked teaching while I was in residency, and the opportunity came up to teach back at Berkeley. So that's kind of how I ended up back up here.
Hmm. Well, that actually takes me right into my next question. Why academia?
I love the interesting cases we get out of school. I know one of the benefits of working in like a private practice in a community is you really get to know your patients, you know, on a, I guess, you know, more personal level. Not that we don't know our patients well at the school, but that's why a lot of people, I think, want to go into private practice. They want to be part of the community. But we often are referral based. So a lot of those people in the community, when they get a case that's maybe a little too complicated for them to handle, will send it to us. And so, yeah, we really get to see some interesting things and are able to help some of the patients where we're kind of like their last hope. They're coming to us kind of, you know, as the last resort. And so that's a lot of fun, and it's really rewarding. So I actually mentor our cornea and contact lens resident at Berkeley. So we're the ones who get to see those patients.
What do you enjoy most about teaching?
You know, I've had the benefit of working with a pretty like wide range of our students. So I teach or I lecture in our second year contact lens course. So that's kind of my first encounters with the younger students. I teach in primary care third year. So not specifically contact lens. This is kind of just general primary care optometry. And then I teach fourth years in advanced contact lens, where they kind of get their first exposure to this specialty, and then, you know, seeing whether or not maybe they would want to pursue a residency in it. And then I work with the residents. So it's a lot of different levels, and it's kind of fun to see. I get a lot of repeat students in various years, so it's kind of fun to watch them grow. You know, this year my resident is someone that I worked with as a third year, so it was kind of fun to see her progress throughout her time in school and thereafter. It's just really rewarding. It's fun to, I think, be around students. They're usually really excited about learning things, and it makes it hard to become a complacent, you know, complacent doctor, because, you know, you're always learning about kind of the latest and greatest, and the students are excited about it, so they talk to you about it. It really helps foster your intellectual curiosity, I think, and keeps it there, which I think can be a little harder if you're not necessarily in that environment.
I recall seeing that one of your job titles is chief mentor at the School of Optometry. What three important principles do you follow when mentoring OD students?
So the chief mentor actually refers to the resident. But I suppose I really, when I talk to students or residents, I really encourage them to be active learners. And again, to not just kind of go with the flow. Like if I tell them, you know, if you go back and you review what you've learned, it'll stick with you longer than if you kind of just go through the motions. So, part of it is also trying to be a good role model. You know, I want to make sure that the way that I communicate with patients and how they see me communicate and give consultations to patients is, you know, something that they would want to, you know, bring into their own practice and something that they would want to model after. Because you remember attendings in school who, you know, I remember the ones where the patients really appreciated their time and the care that they were given. In our profession, I feel like we're blessed to be able to give more time to our patients. Especially if you're in a specialty area. So it's something that, you know, is something I want to teach, is like, even if you're in a busy private practice, figuring out ways to really connect with those patients is important, and I hope that they're learning that.
What's something your colleagues don't know about you?
That's an interesting question. They definitely know I love dogs. They definitely love dining and travel. I suppose maybe a lot of them might not know like how I got into optometry to start with. My parents are both in kind of science fields. And I got to Cal undeclared. Like, I didn't know exactly what major I was going to be in and what profession I wanted. I leaned towards healthcare. And after kind of exploring the various types of healthcare I could look into, so, you know, pharmacy, dentistry, medicine, optometry, et cetera, I actually landed in optometry from our pre-optometry group on campus, but I wanted to take a gap year before I made my final decision, much to my mother's dismay. She's like, what do you mean you're going to take a year off? And I'm like, you know, I want to make sure this is what I want to do. So I actually had arranged to go back to Thailand. And I was going to work in a couple eye hospitals there as a volunteer. So I moved back there for 6 months. And at the time, I don't know, my parents didn't really know this. You know, optometry did not really exist in Thailand at the time. We had ophthalmology and we had opticians, and optometry was kind of just starting to be developed there as a solid profession. So I got there thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to see optometrists, I'm going to see ophthalmologists at this hospital. And what I found was there were only ophthalmologists there, and people, these are government hospitals, so people were being bused in from rural areas to this hospital, like hundreds and hundreds of people taking the whole day off to come to be seen for like 5 minutes. They're very quick exams, and they're waiting there all day. But the government pays for it, so that's the reason that they came. And I was watching these things, you know, these exams go by, and I'm like, gosh, you know, this is the stuff that optometrists do. Like, they're doing anything from refractions to contact lens checks, you know, ulcer checks, somebody who came in for a red eye. But then they also did surgery. So it was quite a spectrum. So there wasn't really a big separation between primary eye care and then, you know, specialty in surgical eye care at that hospital. So that made a big impression on me. I was like, gosh, you know, this could be so much more efficient if primary eye care was built into this medical model that they had. And so that's actually what really solidified my desire to join a primary eye care field, like optometry back here in the States. And then I was excited to find out later on that they have opened up optometry schools in Thailand since then. And so, you know, it's not the same scope as what we do here, but I think it's a step in the right direction so that, you know, people coming in are not, or the ophthalmologists are not bogged down by doing things that primary eye care could do. And they can use their skills, and that would be better served for different things. So yeah, I'm not sure many of my colleagues know that story. Some of them probably do, but that's how I got into optometry.
You mentioned that you travel and you've been back to Thailand and all that. So what's your guilty pleasure food?
Oh, sushi. I love Japanese food so much, or Japanese food in general. I mean, guilty for me because I left my students for like 3.5 weeks, but I took a 3.5 week trip to Japan a couple of years ago, and it was one of the most fun trips I've ever had. I love Japanese food. I love the culture. It's a really interesting country to visit. And yeah, I could eat it anytime. It's one of those things I just don't get tired of.
What's your favorite sushi roll then?
You know, I actually like going to get nigiri, which is the fish on the rice prepared by like the chef. So they'll call it omakase style, where it's the chef's choice. They'll make it, you know, for you based on whatever's freshest. So whatever is good that day or whatever they're feeling is best to be served that day. So I really enjoy those types of experiences. So that's what I usually do.
What do you love most about what you do?
You know, I work with a population of patients. So with specialty contacts, you're usually working. The most common condition is keratoconus. And those tend to be younger patients. You know, they're diagnosed in their teens to 20s most of the time. And not having clear vision at that age, I think, can really impact them. And so being able to put lenses on in office, and all of a sudden they get to see what they haven't seen in a long time, it's really rewarding. I had a young lady come in. She had never worn contacts before. Her mom has keratoconus, and she has it as well. And you know, she was a little tough. Like it was a challenge to get lenses on her. But once we got them on and, you know, got dialed in the right prescription, she was just like, oh my gosh, mom, I can see your face again. You know, and that's something that it's just I know that sounds a little cheesy, but really, it really made my day.
What is your biggest frustration with optometry?
I guess a lot of it has to do with our limitations with what I think we're taught and what we can actually do. We try, I think, to teach our students the widest scope that we can. You know, we try to teach them anything that potentially they could be able to do if our scope expands, but we're, you know, being a legislative profession is kind of frustrating. You know, I find that in maybe in my specialty, I don't run into it as much as maybe somebody who's more specialized in ocular disease, where we overlap more with ophthalmology. But I see that frustration even throughout primary care. And so, you know, that's probably not going to change for us anytime soon. My hope is that we can be more collaborative down the road and there will be less pushback for things that we think that we can help with to lessen the burden of healthcare overall by being primary care providers in general. And, you know, being more, I guess, acknowledged and respected for what our education has given us and what our skills are. So, you know, there's always, things are always changing. I think they're changing for the better, at least from what I can tell. So I think the future's bright. I think that I'm hoping for more of a collaborative feel throughout, you know, all of the eye care professionals out there.
Where do you see yourself in 10 years?
Oh, I'll still be at the school, you know, as long as they'll have me. Yeah, I see myself. I think I'm a career academic. I really like being in school. I don't see myself leaving it anytime soon. You know, it's funny, 2020 is coming up and we're getting a lot of docs who are leaving and retiring. So I think, you know, colleagues will change. I'm probably going to see myself being in the shoes of hopefully one of those people who are helping mentor the younger academics who are just starting out, just like my mentors do for me now, as you're like kind of navigating how do I get promoted? Like, what are all the things I need to do? You know, I have really great people who are able to answer those questions for me now. And, you know, I hope to be able to pay it forward for new people who might be interested in this as a career down the road.
Now we're at our last question and we inflict this one on everyone.
Okay.
What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
Okay, this is a good one. So oh, I have to go to my memory banks and just pick one. No, just kidding. So I decided a couple of years ago I was going to go skydiving. Mm-hmm. And while that might not seem that crazy in and of itself, I'm sure lots of people have gone skydiving. I planned this trip. It was going to be in San Diego. And it was right after a wedding of my friend. I was in the wedding. My boyfriend and I went down there, and it was for his 30th birthday. And so we, you know, drive up to the place. It's like an airfield, a small one. And, you know, we do the thing where we sign our life away on a waiver. And, you know, you do a tandem jump, so you have somebody with you. And they jump with you. So our two guys came over. And they're like, okay, you know, this is how you put the harness in. So we're all strapped in. And as we're walking towards this little airfield, you know, some people were joking around with us earlier about, I guess they kind of joke around to try and make you more comfortable. Mm-hmm. So we had a guy drive up in a van. He's the guy who like picks you up at the landing site and brings you back to your car. And he pulls up to us and he's like, oh, are you so-and-so's friend? I can't remember the name he used, like Sarah, let's just say. And we're like, and he goes, just want to let you know she's in the ICU. She's fine. And we kind of look at each other and he's like, just kidding. You know, they were kind of joking. Mm-hmm. So as we walk out to the airfield, we see the little tin can Cessna, you know, plane that's going to take us up. And the owner is walking down towards us with our guys. Our guys are like ex-military. They're really serious. And he goes, we can't take off. There was a plane crash. And the guys behind me, they're like, don't listen to him. He's just messing with you. And he's like, no, seriously, there was a plane crash. And he points down the runway in the distance. So we see smoke. And so it was a small plane, didn't have to do with this company or anything like that. So we were grounded. Air traffic control won't let planes up until this is cleared. So we had a flight back home later that evening. So we're like, gosh, you know, we could wait around a little bit, but we're probably not going to make it. So we left, wanted to watch a movie to kill some time. And then as the movie ends, I get a text message from the owner and it's like, hey, you know, we're up and running again if you guys want to come back. But, you know, the flight was coming up and I was like, oh, we're not going to make it. But then my boyfriend looks at his phone. He's like, our flight just got delayed 3 hours. So we went back and caught the last jump of the day. Like, it was sunset. People think I'm crazy, but I'm like, hey, statistically, what are the chances of like two plane crashes in the same time or the same place, the same day? I'm like, if anything, this is the best time to jump. So that was the craziest thing I've ever done, I think. And it was really fun. I go back and forth as to whether or not I would do that again. Probably. But it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Really fun, kind of thrilling experience. So, but yeah, some people called me crazy for that.
Okay, Pam, that's all the questions I got for you. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me today.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me. And I appreciate you guys interviewing people like me. I was surprised that I got asked.